I have just finished a book on Holden Village, and I agreed to do a session on the way the book came to be and some of the processes we used. And I've titled it, this session, With Fear and Trembling, A Book About Holden. And the reason for that title is, I discovered as I was working on the book, I knew some of this in advance, but I really discovered as I was working on the book that a lot of people were nervous about there being a book written on Holden Village. Some people, in fact, didn't think there should be a book, and I'll get into that a little later. The book looks like this. Some of you have discovered it. We're going to have a little autograph party at 5 o'clock for any of you who have acquired it and want it signed. We'll do that up under the trees near the patio at 5. And I can pass this around for those of you who want to have a look at it. This is the ninth book that I have my name attached to, and it's the first among all of the nine. It's the only one where I had the feeling, as I did it, that I had scores of people looking over my shoulder. That's because the nature of the Holden Village, as you perhaps know, and the nature of this book project is such that a lot of people have a very intense and emotional interest in what is said and what is done with the village. That isn't necessarily bad. In fact, I don't think it's bad at all, essentially. But it did create, the fact that there would be a book on the village did create a certain anxiety level in some people. I think a relative few who felt that the book would not be done right, or it wouldn't be handled in a way that dealt with their role in the village correctly. It's just a very emotional subject for a number of people who've been associated with Holden Village these last 25, 26 years. The subject matter is of intense interest to a great number, which has not been true of any other book I've ever worked on. I wish it were so, because that gives you a kind of built-in audience that you know you're writing for and that you expect may be interested enough to buy the book. But all of those people who have that kind of intense interest also have a strong opinion about how the story should be told. And the reviews aren't in yet. And the book came off the press about 3 weeks ago. We don't know what the reviews from those people are going to say. We already know there are a few errors in it that have to be corrected in a second printing, which we hope there will be. We know there are some omissions that should be redressed. There were also a few people all through the quarter century, because a book project had been talked about at least 20 years ago. In the board minutes, there is indication of discussion within the board about the need, as some felt, for a book on Holden and how it came to be a church renewal center. But it didn't happen until this last year. All through that period, there were some who felt there ought not be a book on Holden Village. Why? Because there's a certain mystique about Holden that you should not try to capture in words or pictures on paper. And I have some sympathy for that view. I think the mystique of Holden cannot be captured between the covers of a book. The mystique of Holden really can be found only by, I think, being here, experiencing Holden, and through people. And it's hard to translate people directly into a book, into words on paper. But there have always been some who felt it should not be attempted, it should not be tried, it was a mistake to do it. And so for 25 years it was put off. Last year, the board at its annual meeting, just a year ago this week, decided that there should be a book commissioned, and the trustees were asked to find a writer and make a contract. Well, they found me. They asked me last July 4th, Charlie Mays and Duane Landwerk of the board, the secretary and president respectively, approached me and asked if I would be willing in having a go at this project. And I thought it over for a while and decided to try it. And we wrote a contract that specified that the book should be finished off the press in the village by the beginning of summer season 1987. We made it, I'm happy to say. The reason for that was they wanted it to be part of a 25th anniversary recognition. which this summer is. We signed a contract that provided not for a royalty arrangement, but for a one-time payment to the writer for the writing and the getting the book manufactured, which I did in Minneapolis. It was printed and manufactured and bound by Augsburg, but it's not an Augsburg-published book. The publisher is Holden Village, Holden Village Press. This is the first book from Holden Village Press. Whether there will be others, we don't know, but this is the first venture into publishing by Holden Village. And the contract called for a one-time fee payment to me for my time and energy in getting the project completed. So I have no further stake in whether it sells a single copy. I do not benefit personally. I'm interested in it selling because I want people to have a chance to read the story of Holden Village. We printed 10,000 copies. We believed that probably 10,000 copies would sell through the village store. People who are here would be the primary audience for it. Through the mail, Holden's mailing list is over 20,000. They will be notified about the existence of the book and they can write in for it. And through a few other stores around the country, primarily Augsburg and Fortress bookstores, but a few others, seminary and college bookstores too, perhaps, it will be marketed. Let me say a word about the cover and the title, and then I want to go into the essence of my conversation with you, which is what did I find out about Holden Village through writing this book? I want to give you some sample of the book primarily by reading some quotations from people whose names are significant in the history of this place. The cover was done by Rudy Wendelin, who is an artist, graphics person, recently retired from the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service in Washington. Any of you know Rudy? Have any of you been here when he's been here? He's been here a couple times and has done watercolors on the village. On at least one occasion, he did a number of watercolors, which were then used in an auction to raise money for some village project that was going on at that time in the early 80s. Well, we approached him and said, would you like to do a watercolor that we could use as a cover for this book? And he said yes, and you see the result. Rudy is also, I think you'd be interested in knowing, the longtime custodian of the Smokey the Bear image. He did not originate it. That was done by somebody before his time. But for about the last 30 years, he's been the custodian of that image and the adapter of it and the sort of guardian of it for the Forest Service. There are some who believe they see a Smokey the Bear suggestion, at least, in the cover, or on the cover. I don't know if that's true, but Associate Pastor Barb Rossing of the village thinks that he worked Smokey the Bear into the little kid in the lower right corner who's in a backpack. You may want to think that if it does something for you. Barbara thinks she sees Smokey the Bear there, at least in the hat and maybe the face. The title, I want to credit my wife for the title. Hertha, who is a member of the board currently here, came up with that title. We knew that we wanted to feature the giftness of the village, and the book talks about that throughout. That's kind of a thread that runs through, that the village was and is a gift. It, of course, came to the church and to church people, to church sponsorship as a gift, as a pure gift from Howe Sound Mining Company. But beyond that, Holden continues to be a gift to those who come here. I think we'd probably all agree with that. It stresses as its central theme the giving of God in the grace of God to us, in loving us unconditionally, the gospel as gift. And the village really survives only because of the gift of volunteer labor. It would not make it, as we know it at least, in any other way. If all of us who come here had to pay the full cost of our being here, many of us wouldn't be able to come. And it would be a very different kind of constituency. The current calculation is that about 70% of the cost is paid by the fees that we pay, and the other 30% is in the form of a gift to us, a subsidy to us, primarily through the volunteer labor, the value of the volunteer labor of the volunteer staff. And so the book is dedicated to the volunteers of Holden Village, who, in my opinion, are the reason it works. Without that, it would not work, at least in the way that we know it. And I think in many ways also the people who come here as paying guests also make a contribution, a gift. And I don't mean only the charitable giving that they do, many of us do after we leave here, in an annual gift to the village. I mean the giving we do while we're here, sharing of ourselves. Many guests, at least in the earlier years, this is particularly true, actually engaged in volunteer activity from the moment they got off the bus. I think those of you who were around in the early years remember that. It had to be so to keep the village working. But it's still so to a large degree. And so people are often asked to volunteer for everything from table cleaning to carving ham yesterday. On Saturday night, they asked for ham carvers for Sunday noon meal. So we knew we wanted to stress the theme of gift, and that probably the word gift should be in the title. But what modifier should go with it? Well, my wife came up with the word surprising. And I think that's a good solution to the problem. I think it's a title that, at least for me, wears well. It is and was and always has been a surprising gift, a gift that surprises in many ways. It came to the Lutherans as a surprise, complete surprise. We'll say a little more about that later. How did I go at the task of putting the book together? Well, I had been at the village over the years from 1965 on about 8 or 9 times as a guest and as a faculty person, as a teacher, more recently as the spouse of a board member. And so I knew something about the village, but I needed to do quite a bit of research in order to write the book. So I did 3 or 4 things. I interviewed or heard tapes, listened to tapes by 40 plus people. People who had been around in the early years, people who've been here through the quarter century, and people who had something valid and valuable to share about the village and how it came to be as a church center for renewal. I reviewed all of the board minutes and the reports. Kind of dull business, but you got to do that kind of thing if you're going to write this kind of book. I checked the denominational church body actions, particularly in the 1960s, when there was a closer connection between the churches, the national Lutheran bodies, and the village. The reason was, in those years, the churches were providing subsidy to the village. That ended about the end of the decade. About 1970, that ceased. But in those early years, again, without that gift of money from national church bodies, I think the village would not have survived. It would not have made it. So I checked on that. And finally, I looked at, there aren't many books written about the place. There isn't much available. But there are 2 things that I looked at. One is Nigel Adams' The Holden Mine, From Discovery to Production. Nigel Adams is a person who grew up here. I think he was brought into the village at the age of 3 months by his parents, who were engaged in the mining operation, and he lived here until the mine closed, with time out to go to high school in Chelan or wherever. There was not a high school here. There was a grade school here during those years. But he knows the village intimately as a mining village, and he did his doctoral degree on that subject, and that little volume is available in the bookstore if you're interested. That's the period from 1897, I think, to 1937, when the production, or 1938, when production began. That was very helpful on the early years of the village, the mining years. And then on the same subject, Rudy Edmonds' little booklet, The Mine, Holden Village, which is a very slim little volume that Rudy, who is one of our long-term teaching staff people, wrote some years ago, and that's in the bookstore. Well, what about the subject matter itself? Can you really capture a place like Holden Village in words and pictures on paper? I've already said to you that I don't think you can. Horty Christman, some of you knew Horty Christman, I think, from the late 60s and early 70s. Carol Hinderly, the director at that time, called him the patron saint of Holden Volunteers. He is now deceased, but he was an older person, a retired person, who came up here with his wife for many years and worked as a volunteer. Horty once said, if we ever understood this place, we'd spoil it. If we ever understood this place, we'd spoil it. In other words, we shouldn't try to understand it. We shouldn't try to make rational sense out of it. We shouldn't try to put it down on paper and think we've captured it. I agree with that. I also agree with those who said, as the board said a year ago, we owe it to people who come here and people who never do and never will and cannot come here to somehow try to put some of the story of Holden Village in book form so that they can have it. So that when people come here, as you are here this week, and say, is there something about Holden written down that I can take back to share with my friends who ask about the place and who may never be able to come here? For 25 years, we've had to say, no, there really isn't. Well, now there is. And so I think it is valid to try, at least, to tell the story of Holden to some extent, recognizing that it's always a feeble effort to do that, about a place that is full of mystique and magic, to try to say something about the village between the covers of a book. I think the closest approximation to capturing the village and its meaning really comes through presenting people. And so the book uses lots of quotes and introduces lots of people to the reader and lots of stories. So let me, in the rest of the time that I have before we turn to some questions you may have, let me share with you a number of quotations. Wes Preeb, some of you have gotten to know Wes or you know who he is. In 1957, in June, a little over 30 years ago this moment, he was in Anchorage, Alaska. He was working, he was in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, but he was working as a volunteer up there with a church group on weekends. And some group from that Central Lutheran Church in Anchorage was going on a church outing, a picnic. And he picked up to, while he was waiting for his ride, he says, he picked up that day's newspaper. I think it was June 7th, 1957. And he just happened to come across a little story in there that said, the Howe Sound Mining Company, Chelan, Washington, is closing its mine at the end of this month. It's on the market for sale as a resort. So Wes decided, well, why not write to them? So he wrote Howe Sound Company and asked them, not if they'd give it to the church, but if what the price was, and would they, he said something like, the letters are in the back of the book, something like, it sounds to me, he'd never been here, he said, it sounds to me like it would make an excellent church camp or retreat center. And then Wes said about that, I never really expected the company to give the property away, but I hoped they would perhaps reduce the price or some miracle might happen. Well, of course, a miracle happened. After 3 years of writing letters, he wrote again in 58 when he was a student at Lutheran Bible Institute in Seattle, and he wrote again in 1960. The first two times, the response was the same. The village, intact, all of its buildings and equipment is available for the purchase price of $100,000, which to me today sounds like a real bargain. But in that time, that was a lot of money for anybody to come up with in the church when there were other priorities. And nobody really had a program in mind for the place anyway. And, you know, to go and raise $100,000 to buy a property to do something with didn't seem like it was too likely to happen. And, in fact, it wouldn't have happened. So the third time Wes wrote, still a student at LBI, in 1960, April, he got a telegram back from Salt Lake City, where Howe Sound had a regional office. And the telegram said, please contact, I think it's a Mr. Kirkland, by collect phone call. So Wes called back, and Mr. Kirkland said, we're prepared to give Holden Village to your church, whoever you are. They thought Wes Preeb represented Lutheran Bible Institute. In fact, he was just a student there who used LBI stationery, which he probably wasn't authorized to do. The mine company thought it was dealing with LBI. Well, at that point, when Wes heard of the offer, he went to LBI officials and said, hey, guess what? People want to give us this copper mining village up in the Cascades. At that point, we bring in the president of LBI, President E.V. Stein, who said, shortly after, the offer sounded phony and a bit ridiculous. In other words, they found it hard to believe. It was not credible. But they organized a group that came up, LBI did, to come up here and have a look. And among those was Gil Berg, who was a member of the LBI board, and at that time a Lutheran Free Church layperson who had a fuel oil business in Seattle, who got very excited about the place and its possibilities. This was mid-1960 now. I'll come back to Gill a little later. He was a key early figure in making the village go, and there were others. Another quote that I want to share is from Carol Hinderly, who was the first permanent director beginning in 1963 and serving till early 1977. Carol said, sometimes I felt it was a shame that God gave a gift like this to God's least imaginative people, the Lutherans. Carol is a Lutheran, so he's talking about himself, but he had the feeling that this place needed imagination, it needed creativity, and the Lutherans were among the least likely people to produce that. Whether you agree with that or not, that's Carol. George Utek, who was here in the early years, a poet pastor of the Lutheran Church at that time, likened the trip into the village and its remoteness through the water, coming through the water, he likened it to our baptism. He said, as in our baptism, we are reborn, subconsciously prepared for a new life by that journey through the water. That kind of decompression chamber, which is the Lady of the Lake, which takes us from our normal world and its hectic pressures to a different kind of setting entirely. So some thought the village would never work as a church center because of its remoteness. You can't drive your car here, for Pete's sake. And that's threatening to a lot of modern Americans. But others thought that was precisely what would make it work. Its remoteness, the fact that it's difficult to get there, and once you're there, you feel that you are, in some sense, cut off from the normal world. As some have said, the world could end and it would take 24 hours before we'd know it at Holden Village, because the newspaper usually comes in a day late. And it's hard to get television and radio reception here. About Gil Berg and Wilt Bergstrand. Wilt Bergstrand at the time was the youth director of the Augustana Church, which became part of the Lutheran Church in America in 1963. Wilt and Gil both as volunteers. For some periods, full-time volunteers, but unpaid people, provided genuine and profound leadership in the years 60 to 63. Many people said about them, without Berg and Bergie, Bergie was the nickname of Bergstrand, it would never have gotten off the ground. So they deserve credit, and the book tries to give that kind of credit, even though they never appear on the list of the permanent directors of the village, the paid people who shaped it after 1963. Carol Hinderly said shortly after he got here to the board, we have the place dropped in our laps before we have the mood or the movement to support a retreat concept in North American Lutheranism. Carol early had the vision that if this was going to work, it could not be a primarily youth camp, which some had seen it as. We didn't need another Bible camp, people said. We had plenty of those. Didn't need another youth facility. If it was going to go, it would have to go as an intergenerational retreat center, such as Carol knew and Mary, his wife, from their experiences in Europe, where they had recently spent some time in the late 50s. So Carol said, we have the place before we have either the mood or the movement to support a retreat concept in North American Lutheranism. I think that was correct. I remember those years. There wasn't much interest among U.S. or Canadian Lutherans in retreat and renewal centers for families and primarily for adults. That has grown, and Holden to this day remains one of the few that U.S. or North American Lutherans have developed. Gene Swihart, who was here for many years, died last fall, but was here over a period of 20 and more years as a volunteer. She said, Carol put a stamp on Holden that I hope will always be there. He let us be ourselves and let us be free in the gospel. I think that was the great gift that Carol Hinderly brought to the village, the constant and strong emphasis on the gospel. Carol used to say things like, we can laugh, we need to laugh about everything associated with Holden Village, lest we make it an idol. And the only thing that is lasting is the gospel itself. And he used to say, If we don't take the village too seriously, then we'll be free to let it go once it has served its usefulness, if that time should ever come. We ought not idolize it. The only allegiance of the people, the community that is here, is to God. Finally, on the Hinderly period, Carroll was director from, almost 14 years, 13 and a half years, from mid-63 to early 77. Fritz Norstad, who succeeded him as the interim director, said, and all of these quotes, by the way, are from the book, "Carroll and Mary Hinderly have built a village that is one of the wonders of the life of the church in our time. I think it is not an overstatement to say it is a unique reality, a unique place. There's nothing else quite like it." Also about the early leadership, Vern Rieke, a law professor at the University of Washington in Seattle from late 1960 until 1978, Vern chaired the board. And there were some rocky times during that 18-year period. Joe Bash, who was one of the early youth department staff people who was on the board, says about Vern heard all sides with respect and kept heads cool when eruptions seemed likely. During those years, the early years, when there was a struggle over what the village should be like and different people had different visions, the early vision was, by the way, LBI decided early on that it could not run this place. It was too big for it, and it gave it to a new corporation, Holden Village Incorporated, which was constituted. But Holden Village Incorporated, at the beginning, was controlled by the youth departments of the Lutheran churches, because it had been seen by them as a place where they could do youth ministry and do training of adults for youth ministry. It did not develop that way, but for the first 3 or 4 years, there was a real tension between the people who were providing the leadership on the board, youth department folks, and some money, and the vision of others, including the Hinderleys, that it had to be something other than a youth, primarily youth center. John Schramm, the second permanent director, he succeeded Fritz Norstad after Fritz was here for one interim year. John said, no matter who followed a strong personality like Carroll, it would have to be demonstrated that the village could live and thrive under different leadership. I think the greatest trauma the village experienced after those early years, when there was question about whether it could be made to go at all, and it didn't build to the point we know today with full weeks every summer week until about the mid-70s. In the early years, it was really doubtful whether it would make it. Beyond that trauma, I think the greatest trauma the village ever had to face was when its first director left. That always happens with an institution. You ask, well, this is so much shaped in the image of one person. Can it possibly exist under somebody else's leadership? John Schramm says, no matter who followed a Carroll Hinderly, it would have to be demonstrated that the village could live and thrive under a different leadership. And John also says that he and Carroll are about as different as you can be, and I think that's true if you know both of them. They are very different, and that was probably a very good thing. John goes on, the village, he said this in 1986 when I interviewed him, the village has a life and is a place of renewal entirely apart from who happens to be its director. So it has been demonstrated that Holden Village can survive any director and the departure of any director. I think that has now been established. Elmer Witt, the third and current permanent director, has said that he thinks one of the secrets to Holden's success is humor. And he talked about that a little bit in his sermon last night, if you were here. Elmer says in the book, Holden is no doubt one of the very few church-related organizations with the word humor in its articles of incorporation. The word humor is in the Holden articles of incorporation as a part of the purpose of the village, to lift up and celebrate life in the form of humor. Elmer also likens the village to a vacant lot, the vacant lot of childhood that many of us recall if we grew up in rural communities particularly. He says it's like the vacant lot of childhood where we can experiment with ideas, express feelings, try rituals, expand horizons. It's a place to explore, to disagree, to share, to argue, to try out old and new outlandish visions of how the gospel leads us in unthought of, unheard of, and unimagined ways. Well, those are a few of the quotes from the book. There are a lot more, and there are some rich stories and anecdotes that I won't share with you now. I'll let you enjoy those as you come across them. Let me conclude by asking this question. What is the distinctive mix that makes Holden work? Anybody who would be asked that question and who knows the village would come up with his or her own list, I suspect. My list has six elements in it, and I want to mention these six things. I think first and foremost it is the gospel and God's word of grace at the heart of it. That is at the heart of the village, it seems to me, is the most important element in what makes it work. That the Christian faith is important to what happens at Holden Village. All people are welcome to come here, believers and non-believers and other believers than Christian, but it is always and has always been very clear that in an unflinching way the village proclaims Jesus Christ is Lord. You are welcome to come here if you don't share that confession. I think the village tries not to be imperialistic about that confession, but the village has always tried to be very clear that that is at the heart of the village's commitment, the proclamation that Jesus is Lord. Secondly, the second element, I think, that makes Holden work is that it is of the church. It is clearly of the church, but it is not controlled by the church establishment. It is both of the church, but not run by officialdom of the church. And I think both the church establishment and all of the others who know the village like it that way. But in the early years, that too was a struggle. If the church national denominations were putting money into this place, shouldn't they have some control over it? That usually follows. Well, maybe that was valid for the first 10 years. That is no longer the case. The village no longer relies on subsidy from the national church bodies. And I happen to think that's just fine. The national church bodies also don't control the board, don't elect it. The board elects itself. It is a self-perpetuating governance structure. There is a connection in the Articles of Incorporation, which have been revised many times. Some seats on the board are assigned to the national Lutheran bodies. There is no official connection to the Lutheran Church in Canada, though there are two seats currently on the board occupied by Canadians. But the national U.S. bodies and the regional jurisdictions in the Northwest have a certain board. The board's own nominating committee suggests names and, in effect, designates people, and those governing structures of the national and regional churches ratify them. Say, yeah, those people are okay with us. But the real control is with the board itself. Now, there are problems whenever you have a self-perpetuating board for anything. But there are also pluses in that, I think, in terms of the relationship with the church. One chapter spends most of itself on that question of relationships, not only with the churches, which has been an interesting story over the quarter century, but also with the Forest Service. The real owner of the place, in terms of landlordship, is the Forest Service. And that's a relationship that has to be constantly worked at and cultivated. The Forest Service could close the place at any time if it decided it had a higher public interest to be served, because this is not the property of Holden Village Incorporated or of the churches or of church people. It's the property of the U.S. government. And so there's a relationship there that is very important. I won't say any more about that. So the second thing that makes the village work, in my opinion, is that it is of the church, clearly, but not controlled by church officialdom. Thirdly, the centrality of community at the village. Holden has always had an important role for community. It is itself a community, that's obvious. It's a community not only in the sense that we become a community for a week when we go to a camp somewhere. It's a community in the sense that people who live and work here have to run an entire small village. They have to worry about things like sewage and road repair and power and water and food. And that's a little bit more than most of us experience when we go to a week-long conference at a motel somewhere. Here, Holden has to provide all of that that we would normally find in a small town of 400 people anywhere in the continent. So Holden is itself a community, year-round a community. In the wintertime, there are usually 70, 80, maybe 100 people here. and in the summertime usually around 400. But Holden is also a place that struggles with what community means. What does it mean theologically? What does it mean to the people of God to be community? And struggles with the problems that come from community life. And there are problems. It is not all sweetness and light. I'll come back to that in a moment. Fourthly, the role of humor, Holden hilarity, which I've already said some things about. A fifth element, it seems to me, is that the volunteer mentality has been present from the beginning. And without it, Holden would not exist. It wouldn't have survived. It wouldn't exist as we know it today. And the sixth element, I think, is the constant linkage between this remote place, which early on was called a place apart, the constant linkage between Holden and the real world, or as people who live here year-round call it, the outside, or they sometimes say the real world, because this, in a sense, is not the real world. And nobody stays here permanently, including those who are on long-term staff. Everybody goes back to that other world eventually. Some of us after a week, some of us after 2 years, some of us after, how long were you here? 3 years. The real world we know is out there. And this is a kind of rehearsal for that, a place of retreat from it to get our act together to go back into it. And I think that's what renewal really means. There's always been a strong linkage. This is not a place of escape from the real world. It's a place to engage the real world in a very special way, even while we are here. Okay, those six elements. Now, let me conclude with this. Holden has continuing challenges that are very serious. And I think often when we're here only for a week, we're not aware of that. But we try to deal with some of that in the book. These are my own opinions about what those challenges are, but they come through talking with many people who've been here for a much longer time than I. Holden needs to counter the image of elitism. It has to deal with the problem of elitism, of being an in-place that is somehow different from the real world and the real church. It has to deal with that, I think. And I don't know that we at Holden always deal with that successfully. But being aware of it, I think, is the first step in dealing with it. To be aware of the image of elitism that Holden can very easily project to others and that is not a healthy thing. Second, to the need to address the tensions between being a long-term community and a ministry of hospitality for one-weekers who come in the summertime. To put it another way, the question is, whose village is it anyway? Whose village is it, really? Is it the village of those of us who come in for typically a week at a time in the summer? Or does it belong to those who are here year-round? Or those who are longer-term staff? That's a tension that has to be addressed. And if you come here in the wintertime, and you're encouraged to do that, it has a very different feel about it than it does in the summertime, I think. It's not that one is good and the other bad, it's just different. So there is that kind of tension. The tension between the more permanent community of people who live here and work here and feel it is their community and those of us who plop in and plop out again as the buses and boats come and go. Ideally, I think, and many of them who have reflected on this would say that, ideally, the long-term community, the year-round community, sees this place as their vocation to conduct a ministry of hospitality. That is their job in life, to conduct a ministry of hospitality for all of us short-termers who come in for a brief time. It is their calling under God to host about 5,000 people during the course of a year who come and go. And they are a worshiping community as they do that. That's a very important element. We devote one full chapter in the book to that, to Holden as worshiping community. Third problem or challenge, I think, is the need to move beyond being a gathering place for middle-class white folks of Northern European origin, to become less homogeneous, to become more inclusive of economic class, of backgrounds other than Lutheran, and of colors other than white. And there'll be a major effort made in the next 2 weeks. The effort's been in the planning stages for a long time, but in the next 2 weeks, after this week, as you may have heard, there will be a program, an emphasis called Rainbow on the Mountaintop, and it's 2 weeks of special effort to provide program leadership in the person of black Americans and to invite as guests blacks from congregations. There will still be a lot of white people here, but most of the leadership, program leadership, will be in the hands of blacks, and there'll be far more blacks in the village than there normally are. Most weeks here in the summertime, if you see one or two black faces out of 400, that's about all you can expect. I think Holden over the years has been even whiter than U.S. Lutheranism, which is pretty white. U.S. Lutheranism, you may know, if you know anything about it, is the whitest major denominational group in the United States. It's about 1% non-white. Well, Holden has been at least that white, and I think that's a problem. Inclusiveness in all respects is something that the current village board and executive leadership is committed to, and they're working at it. A final challenge I see is the need to address what might not seem like a problem to most people, the problem that the best friends of the village love it too much. Dan Erlander puts it this way. Dan was here for a number of years as a staff person, is a pastor who is now in campus ministry at Pacific Lutheran in Tacoma. Dan says, Holden's chief problem is that it is overloved. Some people become so possessive about the place that they are unwilling to let it change. They want it always to stay as they have known and loved it. Well, that can be a problem. When you love something too much, that you won't let it go, you won't let it evolve, you won't let it become something else because it's mine and I want it to stay always the way I knew it. And you become so possessive. I think we can even become that way about our own children. Dan thinks that's the village's chief problem. And that's an unusual kind of problem for us because most of our institutions we don't love that much. If anything, we love them too little. But with Holden, there's a special group of people who are so possessive and so loving of the place that it's hard for us to let it change, to let it become something else. Well, Holden does change, and Holden does change people. I think that's one of the reasons it is so loved by people. It changes lives lastingly and significantly. Many people give testimony to that. Many people say, this is the place where I first found genuine community, or this is the first place I really found the gospel. That kind of thing, which does change lives. Barb Rossing, I'll conclude by quoting from her again, the current associate pastor. She says, what changes people at Holden is the depth of community illuminated by the gospel. People learn to trust other people here and thus to trust themselves. But in the end, it all comes down to trusting the gospel. Okay, let me stop there, and we have about 15 minutes of time for conversation. And I don't claim to be the total historian about the village. I can't answer every question that you might think of, but I'll do my best. And I know a lot more about the village than I did a year ago. Sure. I know them both fairly well. John Schramm and I, were seminary classmates back in the mid-50s at what is now called Trinity in Columbus, Ohio. John chose to be ordained, become a pastor. I chose not to. I wanted to go into church journalism, and I did. But we've been friends for a long time. I knew Carol also very well in the early 60s and late 50s because I was editing youth materials in the last years before the 1960 merger of the ALC. Carol was around the office in Minneapolis at that time, and then shortly after and just before he came to Holden Village. My quick thumbnail assessment of the two of them is that Carol is totally unpredictable, totally unorganized, almost totally unorganized, if that's possible, but he's very close to being totally unorganized, I think, and a very free spirit, and very troubling to a lot of people because of that. He's not a good administrator, he's not systematic, he's not predictable. You cannot pin Carol Hinderly down, but he's always out front. You know he's in the village whenever he's here. I mean, even these days, I think if he were to come back, everybody would know that Carol Hinderly's in the village. He's not a quiet person. He has big ego. I think Carol would admit that is true. I guess a lot of people have big egos, but we handle it in different ways. I think John Schramm probably has a big ego, but he's a very laid-back person. John could be in the village as its director, and you could be in here for a week, and I've heard people say this. They didn't even find out who John Schramm was because he wasn't up front. He wasn't on. He wasn't making announcements. Elmer's sort of in between the two. You see some of Elmer, but not a lot. But John was very much in the background. They both had, I think what they had in common was they were both deeply committed to the gospel. That they had in common. But in almost every other respect, in their style, in their emphases, they were quite different. And are quite different. I don't want to talk about them as though they're deceased. They both still live. But the board, either out of blundering through or in great wisdom, decided to go for a director after Hinderly who was totally different from Carroll. And that's what happened. And I think John's right that that was a wise decision. Because inevitably, comparisons would be made. Those who were very close to Carroll Hinderly thought nobody else could run this place. They'd destroy it. And there was a lot of bitterness because Carroll didn't want to leave. Carroll finally was asked to leave by the board. Variety of reasons. I think the board felt at bottom it was time to make a change because when one person is at one place too long, it's not healthy for the person or for the institution. And so a lot of people who were strong supporters of Carroll and wanted him to continue, and he was very vocal about the fact that he didn't really want to go, they felt that nobody else could come in and do this job and do it right and do it well. And that's why all those quotes about it has been proved that the village could outlive any one director and survive and, you know, it's become bigger than any one person. I think that's true and that's good and that's healthy and that's a very living reality today. But in 1977, it wasn't all that clear to a lot of people. There are still some people who have not come back to the village since Carroll left because they don't think it can ever be what it was. That's some of what Dan Erlander was talking about, I think, when he said, if it changes, it's no longer my village, and I can't identify with it anymore. Yes? Yep. The two had and have very different styles. John Schramm, I think, says in the book that he feels his primary emphasis was to bring in a theology of the cross. That was his primary theological motif. In terms of social justice, they lifted that up probably more than the Hinderleys had, although they were interested in it too. But John and Mary Schramm, that became the major emphasis, social justice. And that bothered some people. There was too much of that, and it was always, they felt, to the left of the political spectrum. And there was criticism of that. John and Mary also were strongly into lifestyle simplification, against consumerism in our society. That reflected itself in the food, in the menu. There's some vestiges of that to this day, although I think it's more moderate today than it was in their period. We talk about all that in the book. Even food at Holden became a political issue. I think it still is. I mean, there's a politics of food that's going on, and every time the board meets, it seems to be on their agenda. One year, I'll just tell you this little story, about five, 6 years ago, I think it was, somebody on the board brought a motion to the board that the board rule, board's supposed to set policy, right? Well, this board member thought the board should rule that the salt shakers should be taken off the table in the dining room. Why? Because people don't know what's good for them. They're eating too much salt on their food, and we should control that by as we control what they eat when we order food and prepare it. Well, let's go all the way and take salt shakers off. It didn't pass, but there was a substantial minority supporting it. So all of that gets in. What kind of model does the village set for the way things ought to be, including the way our diets ought to be? Well, that's a very important question. You don't just go into running a village without raising those questions or dealing with them or answering them. And so even food at Holden has been an issue, and it became a major issue in the Schramm period when red meat was really ruled out. During the Hinderly time, I think there was a lot more what we would call cuisine, fine cuisine dining, than there has ever been since. I feel this year, I've been here now 4 days, there is more of a pendulum swing back toward the middle than I've experienced in the last few years, the last several years. So that's another thing you can watch at Holden, how the food issue changes and evolves over the years. Anybody else? Yeah. Well, there is a 5 o'clock autograph party today in just a few minutes up under the tree. So if any of you have bought books and want me to sign them, I'll be happy to do that. Or if you want to buy them then, I'll be happy to do that. And after that that hour, 5 to 6, throughout the rest of the time I'm here, yes, I'll be happy to write in your copy of the book. Oh, good question. What the mining company owned was the properties on the land. The land belongs to the U.S. government through the U.S. Forest Service, which is part of U.S. Department of Agriculture. The buildings belong to the mine, the mining company, and all of the equipment, and even some actual land across the creek, which is mining claims, belongs to Holden Village Incorporated, and half of the mining rights, if they should ever develop the mine again or ever extract, they'd probably do it under contract. I don't think the village would run the mine, but under contract to a developer. They might at some point in the future, if copper price goes up, go back in and extract. Half of the mining claim is owned by Lutheran Bible Institute of Seattle. Because the gift was originally given to LBI, that's the one thing that LBI has retained, half of the interest in the mining claim. Now, there is also a lot of gold in the tailings. There's other mineral in there too. Because the price of gold has not been high enough to justify going in and taking it out, or the technology hasn't been developed to do it efficiently, that has never been mined. But there are those who say that when the price of gold today gets up around $380 an ounce, I think it is, which it currently is at, it would be economic to go in and take the gold out of the tailings. It's gold dust. So the board periodically has wrestled with that question. Should we go in and or give somebody the right to go in under our supervision and take the gold out of the tailings? And then as the price of that, as part of the deal, that they have to dispose of the tailings too. That would be a way of getting rid of the tailings. Well, I don't think it's a live option immediately, but at some future time it could happen. Again, if the Forest Service would agree. The Forest Service would like to get rid of the tailings. They consider them not only a visual eyesore, but an environmental pollutant for Railroad Creek and when the wind blows for the air, the atmosphere around here. But there is ownership by Holden Village Incorporated of the buildings in the village, and of some acres of mining claim across the creek. Anybody else have a question or comment or corrective? Incidentally, if any of you on reading the book discover an error or a serious omission, something that you know the village, the period that's being written about, and you think something really ought to be corrected, let me know or let the village know, because when the second printing comes along, we hope to make corrections. And we already know of a few errors that have to be corrected.
I was just going to say, some of those you said there's some.
Oh, there's stupid things. In the introduction, I talk about the fact that, and maybe this is a good note on which to close, some had seen this year as a 25th anniversary of the village, as a church center. As a mining village, it's really the 100th year from the discovery of the lode in 1887, the original discovery. Then Holden rediscovered it and actually developed it, began to exploit it, sold shares in a company and so on after the 1890s. But it goes back 100 years. As a church operation, does it go back to 1960 when the gift was made? Some say that's the beginning of the village as a Lutheran operation. Does it go back to 61 when the first group of work campers came in and the first program was actually offered? There was 1 month of program offered the summer of 61 by LBI Seattle. I happen to think that's the beginning date of the village as a Lutheran operation, offering program to people. Bible study and environmental study they did for 4 weeks that summer. 1962 was the first fairly complete summer, and I guess that's why many people date it from 62, and so this is called a 25th anniversary year. That's okay, except the people who were here in 61 resent it. It's like they're being ignored or didn't count. Some say the village as we know it today really began with the arrival of Carol Hinderly, summer of 63, and you ought to date it from that. Well, in concluding that little discussion in the introduction, I say, however you date it, what I wrote was, however you choose to date the village, it is clear that it is nearing the end of its third decade as a church venture. How it came out was, it is nearing the end of its first decade. No proofreader caught it. I didn't catch it, my wife, all the others who read the proof didn't catch it, because first was spelled right. No, it wasn't a typo, it was just the wrong word. So that's a mistake, and we have to correct things like that. Yeah, there's a book launching ceremony. Yes, yes. So I think we'll close it here. Thank you all for coming. And the ceremony up on the under the tree at the picnic table will be a lot of fun, even if you don't buy a book, because the bored spouses of the spouses of the bored, who are often bored unless they find something to do, have planned something hokey. I don't know what it is, but we'll go and see.